This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today in the program, a panel of experts discusses the increasing frequency and severity of drought in Utah, and how changes to water use can make the state more resilient in the face of a warming climate. Last summer, the Great Salt Lake hit historic lows not seen in over a century and a half. If the shrinkage of the lake is not stopped, researchers at Weber State University say it could mean cascading negative effects on Utah's wildlife, economy, and air quality. However, a new bill before the Utah legislature could be a step in the right direction. The Great Salt Lake Drought Contingency Bill would impose secondary water fees when the lake falls below certain thresholds. This would balance Utah's inordinately low water costs, which are usually covered by property taxes, against the needs of the lake, to create a market-based incentive to conserve water and preserve one of the state's natural wonders. The panel includes Seth Arns, research scientist at the Western Water Assessment and affiliate at the Global Change and Sustainability Center and the U Water Center, Juliet Carlisle, associate professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Utah, Phil Dean, public finance senior researcher at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute, and Teresa Wilhelmsen, state engineer and director of the Utah Division of Water Rights. This panel is moderated by Carrie Case, chief sustainability officer at the University of Utah. This forum was put on in partnership with the University of Utah's Office of Sustainability. This forum was recorded on September 15th, 2021. Here is your moderator, Carrie Case.
Let's jump in with my first question. Is this the worst drought Utah has experienced? What are the compounding effects of this drought, and what groups are already being affected? And Phil, if you'd be so kind, I'd love to pass this over to you first and then invite the rest of our panelists to join in.
Yeah, so we'll talk about this from an economic perspective, that this has had broad-based impact. I don't think we've had severe economic impacts across the board for all types of business, but there are certainly some sectors of our economy that are seeing very significant impacts. I'd say especially the agricultural community in the state that's experiencing significant impacts. That being said, it is something that impacts all of us, even though some sectors are more water intensive than other economic sectors. It's something that I think we all need to be paying attention to, even if we're not right now.
I'll chime in a little bit too and say that, you know, one of the things that I think is important to talk about, we're going to talk a lot about drought. And one of the interesting things about drought is that there's really no sort of legal or agreed upon definition of what a drought is. There's a lot of ways to measure components of maybe low water or precipitation, low stream flow, low groundwater, but you know, states don't necessarily have a legal definition or a statute that determines when a drought is in existence. So that's important to understand too. So it's important to also acknowledge that while we live in an extraordinarily dry part of the country, that this is not the first time we've experienced a water shortage. Our water shortages have occurred in the past, but our current water shortage is really something that's been ongoing for the past 20 years or so. So a couple of decades we've been enduring this. And some people refer to this, or scientists refer to this, as a mega drought. I think we're gonna get to that in a little bit. But I think that's important to acknowledge. And the effects that it'll have on certain people, of course, we're gonna be looking at ranchers and their ability to sustain their cattle, particularly in terms of water, but also in the hay that they might be growing to forage their cattle. Developers are going to be experiencing problems. This is particularly relevant, I think, to Utah as a state that has been seeing a lot of in-migration and where are we going to house these people? And in fact, some small towns in Utah have put moratoriums on actual building. So this is going to affect developers. So those are a couple of entities that, of course, it'll impact, but also our wildlife. If you think about wildlife such as fish and how tributaries and rivers and streams are becoming drier and drier, and the ability for our state fish, the cutthroat trout, to spawn is becoming problematic. So there's a lot of impacts that we see.
So I can speak to how bad this drought is from a more climatological perspective, and looking through a broader lens of maybe the last 1,000 years or so. So Juliet brought up the term mega drought. So this current drought that we're in, many in popular media and scientists have begun to call drought in this region a mega drought. So what we mean by a mega drought is a drought that lasts, that's decadal or multi-decadal. So a drought that's 10 years or multiple decades long. And depending upon where we're actually looking at drought in our state, in our region, it absolutely meets that criteria. So for example, in the Four Corners region, southeastern Utah, that part of our state absolutely has been in drought since about the year 2000. Even here in Salt Lake City, if we look at drought information, we have really been in, if we just look on a little bit shorter of a scale than multi-decadal, since the middle of the summer of 2011, we have been under drought conditions in Salt Lake City for the entire time, except for a very brief period. Or I'm sorry, this is data from the entire state of Utah. If we look at Utah as a whole, we've been in drought in Utah for that entire 10 years, except a short period in 2018, 2019, where we had a very good winter in 2019, but then we had a hot, dry summer. Now, if you look at this from an even broader perspective, what's happened over the last 1,200 years, we have, as scientists, we have a good understanding of regional drought going back about 1,200 years, by looking at tree rings in long-lived trees and comparing those tree rings. And you can compare the annual growth rings of trees to climate records in the observed period. Then you can create a model and extend that relationship back in time to as old as the trees are. Now, if we look at that record, we can look at this regional drought, and it ranks somewhere between probably second or third worst drought in the last 1,200 years, borderline the first drought, but I think it's definitely fair to say that the current drought is among the three worst droughts that we've seen in Utah and regionally in the last 1,200 years. And I do want to just make one more statement about some of the impacts that we're seeing from that climate perspective. Sorry, Teresa. But we're seeing in some of our largest reservoirs and largest lakes, we're seeing record low elevations of these lakes. The Great Salt Lake, which is a natural system, reached its lowest elevation since we started keeping records going back to 1860. This lowest elevation was reached just about a month ago. And Lake Powell, which is one of the largest reservoirs in our region, reached its lowest elevation and amount of water storage back in early August.
So maybe just to bring kind of a more of a practical what happened this year in Utah relating to the actual deliveries of water. And this is from a truly water rate perspective. And it, you know, the conditions that have been described here, just the dry soil conditions, the weak to average snowpack, little spring runoff, and the high temperatures really led us to curtailing direct flow and storage rights earlier than in some years. As Phil mentioned, and also Juliet, I would also say that what we saw in this season was the hardest impacted were farmers and ranchers. and those that had storage rights actually fared better than those that just relied on the direct flow rights that they have. And as water managers, we did see that the resiliency that is built, and I know we're going to talk about resilient communities a little later, but the resiliency that is built into our public supply systems, you know, imports of water, multi-year reservoirs, groundwater, it did help the cities not feel the same effects as agricultural users. So that's kind of what we saw from a water right perspective.
Thank you all. So I hear some consensus that we're definitely in mega drought, right? As Julia made sure that we all know, we are in an arid region and low water years are definitely part of what happens in our region. Seth, I'm wondering if you could say a little more about how the current drought and the current situation fits with climate change models.
Sure. Well, when we think about climate change in our region, I like to talk about the things that we're most certain about first. So with thinking about climate models, the two most basic outputs of a climate model that projects future climates out to the year 2100 are future temperatures and future precipitation. To develop projections of climate change, there are multiple models that are considered. There's maybe a suite of about 30 to 50 global climate models that are often used individually or averaged together to come out with an idea of what future climate looks like. And these models use different assumptions, different ways to calculate climate. All of these climate models agree that temperatures in Utah and regionally are going to increase. We've seen an increase already in the 20th century of about 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit across the state of Utah. Climate models all agree that this temperature change is going to increase. And by the end of the century, depending upon what emission pathway we're on, meaning how much greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, other greenhouse gases are emitted over the next 70 years, that's going to depend on whether there's a 6 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature to a 10 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature for Utah. So we're very certain as scientists and climate modelers that temperature will increase. Precipitation, we're a little less certain about because it's more complicated in general. And for our region in particular, we're at kind of a convergence of weather patterns in Utah, especially northern Utah. Take El Nino and La Nina years. They don't necessarily predict anything for Utah. And that's kind of one of the, Utah is in this convergent zone, especially northern Utah for climate patterns. So if you look at climate models projecting precipitation, most models show a slight to modest increase in precipitation. Some models show a decrease in precipitation. If you average that out for northern Utah, it comes to maybe like a 4 to 7% increase in precipitation by the end of the century. But not all climate models show that. So I'm just saying that because I like to let's focus just on what temperature will do to drought. What temperature does to drought is it makes it so that less water is available. Meaning if it rains an average amount in Salt Lake City, what we've considered averaged over the last 30 years, which is about 14 inches of annual precipitation. In 30 years from now, 40 years from now, if we get that same 14 inches of precipitation, and the temperature is 4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, then we're actually going to be in drought conditions. What was once considered an average condition now becomes a drought condition. That's because those higher temperatures evaporate water from soils, from lakes, from rivers, from reservoirs, and it also causes plants to use more water through transpiration. So essentially in a climate where it's 4 degrees warmer, this isn't going to be a precise number, but we might need 17 or 18 inches of precipitation just to maintain that same landscape. So higher temperatures alone will drive the system more towards drought conditions. And in fact, this drought that we're in right now is really, really has only become a mega drought because we've had higher temperatures. if it weren't for these higher temperatures, we still would have seen drought conditions over the last 20 years, but it would certainly not rank among the top three worst droughts in the last 1200 years. So really the take home is here is that drought, like Juliet said, dry years will always happen in our region. Drought is part of the natural cycle and fluctuation of climate. However, higher temperatures alone will push the system towards less water available and more drought. And then if we happen to have a decrease in precipitation, that would push, or more dry years, that would push things even more in the direction of drought. Also, it's expected under climate change to see more extremes. So that means more extreme, the wet years are probably going to be wetter with more intense rainfalls. The dry years will likely be drier and more intensely dry.
That was Seth Arns, research scientist at the Western Water Assessment and affiliate at the Global Change and Sustainability Center and the U Water Center. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today, a panel discusses how Utah can become more resilient in the face of severe drought. Here again is your moderator, Carrie Case, Chief Sustainability Officer at the University of Utah.
Keeping on this idea of drought and impact of climate change, I want to share that over the past year, the University of Utah just completed its first climate resilience assessment. And as part of this process, we identified numerous climate-related vulnerabilities for the U. And I'm sure it is surprising to no one on this panel that more frequent and severe drought was one of the threats that we identified. And over the next year and a half, we will undergo a process to develop a new climate action plan for the university with a focus on improving climate resilience, helping us figure out how to address the implications of future drought and a whole bunch of other climate impacts as well. And we're particularly interested in thinking about how we prioritize those that are disproportionately impacted by climate change, both on our campus and in the surrounding community. So as we prepare as the university to undertake this work, I would love to hear what you experts think a drought resilient community looks like. What does that mean and what could that be? And Juliet, I'll pass this one to you first to share your thoughts.
Great. Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, we have to think about ourselves as part of many communities. So we're part, those of us who are working at the U, we're part of a community that includes our peers and that includes our students, that includes staff. But we're also part of the Salt Lake community. We're also part of the Utah community, and we're part of sort of the Western region community, the Colorado River community. And so, you know, we can think about this as a problem that will impact and have perhaps many layers of effects on individuals. You know, I think about this in terms of the sort of privilege that most of us have. We wake up every day and we turn on our tap and water comes out of it. And so that sort of privilege doesn't exist for everybody, and there could be more vulnerability for certain groups, and the stress and anxiety that water access and water quality has on people can certainly impact not only sort of how they navigate their lives, but also sort of the emotional and psychological stress, you know, all the different aspects of life that are obstacles create stress for people. And mental health is something that obviously is super prevalent in the Intermountain West. And so the drought and the stress of water access and water quality can certainly compound that stress for certain groups. So I think thinking about that will definitely promote resiliency. I think it's also important that for, you know, layers of organizations to work together. So, you know, the university working with the city, the county, the state, all of these entities are communicating and thinking about the different stakeholders. You know, when we think historically about some of the policies that were implemented, they were implemented mostly to the benefit of certain few, right, at the sacrifice of others. So I'm thinking of, you know, those who were irrigating you know, using water for agriculture. Their sort of priority came obviously before those of even Native Americans who lived here much longer. So there are certain groups and categories of groups who probably will struggle more. And so our policies have to invite more people to the table. Our solutions have to think about all these different groups of people and be collaborative. So, you know, we think about ways that we as a community at the university could contribute to resiliency. You know, I think Phil's gonna talk a little bit about pricing. But, you know, the university uses quite a bit of water as an entity and an organization. And, you know, are they paying their fair share? Phil might have some interesting thoughts on that. So we as a community, we're taking responsibility for our own sort of contributions to the problem. But it's just sort of thinking of all those different ways that we as homeowners can plan and think about retrofitting our yards and our gardens and our landscapes at the university as well, in developing the city, the state. All of these things are going to become vitally important.
Any other thoughts on resilience? Teresa, I know you sort of mentioned it in one of your previous comments. Anything you want to add here before we talk a little bit about economics, because we're going there next?
Sure. So as far as, I was looking at the chat, sorry, got a little distracted there for just a moment. As far as resiliency in I guess, systems or community from an engineering standpoint and from a water rights standpoint, I think that for us, building resiliency is a system that has accurate measurement and accounting and shared transparency of the records. You know, as water managers, we look to actions of our predecessors and the redundancies that have been built into many of the public systems. Just for example, like the drought in the early 1930s resulted in the creation of a drought relief program. And water managers realized the need for successful projects like the Central Utah Project or the Provo River Project and others that actually people had the foresight to build and construct. And sometimes those aren't the most popular, but you know, the Salt Lake Valley that, you know, as Juliet mentioned, wouldn't have the water that it has if it weren't for these projects and the planning of our predecessors and doing what they did develop. And moving forward, I think we need to understand just more of the water demands, our supply, and just continue to develop more solutions. You know, does that mean facilities, storage, import water, groundwater and healthy aquifers, conservation, optimization, you know, things like reuse of water, those types of things, they're all talked about. And I think kind of throwing to a cost piece here, I think once demand meets up with the cost of some of those innovations, you may see some additional changes that occur in policies. So I'll leave it at that.
One more comment about building drought resiliency. I think one thing that's really important that I don't want to overlook in this group, because I think we all have a similar understanding about current conditions and how those may change in the future. I think building drought resilient communities needs to be informed by the best science first. And I think part of that is, you know, while there's certain sectors or locations in Utah that there is a really good understanding of current conditions and that this may get worse in the future. I don't think that's the case in all sectors in all parts of Utah. So I think there needs to be work by, you know, groups like Western Water Assessment and other scientists and organizations that can help inform different levels of management throughout the state, from the individual all the way up to the state government and federal management agency level. I also think that coordination is really important. Oftentimes, different aspects of water management can get kind of compartmentalized, be it in our state government or federal management agencies or, you know, local versus county. So I think that greater coordination amongst all these different groups involved in water management is also really important.
Can I echo that? That's what I was going to say a minute ago, that I think there's a lot of improvement that needs to occur in terms of these interrelationships, sometimes with government entities, sometimes private sector actors involved. But you look at land use planning. How is land use planning incorporating water use planning? How, and unfortunately, a lot of times these things operate in silos. And some of the political incentives inherent in that are, well, that's not my business, that's somebody else's business to worry about that. Where I think we need to do a much better job in the state at taking a comprehensive view, at seeing the whole picture and not just viewing one single element in isolation by itself, but viewing the interactions that take place and the entire system of water, not just from like a physical delivery standpoint, but from an economic standpoint, from a climate standpoint, from, you know, Great Salt Lake, all of these things, we need to look at it together and not just this little narrow view that often sometimes takes place.
Thanks, everybody. And maybe let's take a minute now and dig a little deeper into this economic side that we've been talking about a little bit. So how do we as consumers pay for our water? Does Utah's current payment strategy encourage reducing water use? And is the pay strategy fair to all incomes? Phil, I think I'll kick this one to you, as it seems like it may be in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, and there's a lot to unpack there, right? So I'll kind of take a first stab at it and then we can maybe follow up some more. The first thing, you know, as an economist, as I think about any good or service that's provided about out there, you think about how is it provided, who's providing it. And one of the key elements as we think about demand for water is what is the pricing of that water. So if I think about my demand for oranges, for example, well, that's going to depend a lot on how much I'm getting charged for an orange. If I'm paying 50 cents for an orange, I might want a certain amount. If I'm paying 20 bucks for an orange, I'm going to want a much different amount. And so prices send very strong signals to people and we react to those. So now kind of bringing that into the world of water, we kind of have different ways that we do and can deal with water, which is a scarce resource, by the way, like all other resources out there that are also scarce. And in, you know, especially with deep government involvement in water, we have what are called command and control mechanisms, or we have market mechanisms. And we have a combination of those that are used. So you think a command and control regulation might be some zoning ordinance that you have to have a certain amount of turf in your grass, in your yard, or it might be limitations on an amount of turf. Historically, the way zoning ordinances have worked, they've encouraged more and more and more turf. I think that's changed some, but I think there's still some additional adjustments that need to take place there. But pricing is another tool in the toolbox. And in my view, I think that tool has been underutilized historically in Utah. And as we keep bumping up against these constraints, as we have population continuing to grow, at best, you know, looking to the future, from everything I've heard, we have the same amount of water, but probably less, that we're dealing with a growing population. I think pricing pricing does a lot of things that command and control mechanisms can't. A lot of times people will figure out ways to work around or to kind of game the system with command and control mechanisms, but it's a lot harder to do with pricing. Last piece I want to touch on there is I think it's important to be very cognizant as we think about pricing to make sure that basic water use remains affordable. So, your drinking water that you actually use to drink, your basic hygienic use of water, those sorts of things, I think it's critical that water remain very affordable. But I also think it's critical that the more discretionary uses of water start to have to face trade-offs that maybe we haven't had to face as a state. And as we think about that, we had these big rains come through a couple weeks ago. I've shared this example before, but on my way home, I was driving about 2 miles from the grocery store. And while it was pouring, remember how we like have flash flood warnings here 2 or 3 weeks ago? I counted 5 businesses or homes watering their grass. Right. And so when that's happening, it tells me that's a really low value use. Right. And some of that will probably end up recharging aquifers or whatever. But we've gone to all this effort and expense to capture that water, to treat it, to deliver it. And then we're, in my view, mismanaging it. Right. That's not a productive use of that water. Similarly, I think about business use. I think we need to think about where is the economic growth going to occur in the state? And do we want to incent a very aggressive water user types of businesses? Maybe if they come on their own, that's one thing, but do we want to go about incenting that? And I think that's starting to become part of the discussion at the state level of, maybe being more picky about the types of businesses that we incent to come to the state.
Can I weigh in for a minute too? I think one of the things that's really important to the audience is that although we're, I think, the second driest state in the nation, we have the lowest price for water, and our water is subsidized heavily. So that's what makes the water so cheap. And so as Phil, is basically saying is that, if market principles were applied, it would probably increase the cost. And when you increase the cost of a commodity, you decrease demand. And so what's interesting is that, our state has this huge subsidy, which makes water consumption extraordinarily cheap. And if we could actually increase the cost of it for maybe these superfluous uses, then the demand would perhaps go down. People would be more apt to conserve water the more expensive it got. We have a state that is unwilling to possibly remove that subsidization of our water. Legislatures and the governor haven't put that on the agenda of something to do, as far as I know. So that's certainly something that, that should be considered as well, in terms of how we think about paying for water.
And can I follow up on that? We put out a report from the Gardner Policy Institute looking at user fees broadly. So not just water, but for roads, for higher education, other areas that, that do user fees. But one of the things that we have in there is we looked at how much of our funding for water is tied to a water fee that's based on use directly, like your level of use, versus how much is paid through other sources like a property tax or a monthly fee that doesn't tie to your level of use, right? And these are really rough numbers here that I'll throw out, but we're in the range of about $1 billion that we use to pay for water in the state. And roughly a little under $700 million of that does not directly tie to use. So again, a portion of that, make sure I have the right number here, but about $250 million of that is a monthly fee. So it is a user fee for water, but it's not based on use. It's just a flat fee that whether you use 1 gallon or you use 1 million gallons, you pay that same flat fee. But the portion of the water funding that's directly tied to use, you know, is somewhere in that range of 35%. That doesn't create a very strong economic incentive to be judicious in our water use.
I have a follow-up question on this topic from a member of our audience. They ask, how would you determine if someone or a business is using water for drinking and hygiene versus for unnecessary uses?
So I want to jump in on this one. It's one of those things as an economist that I think about a lot. What is a good use of water, right? So for me, what I would personally consider an essential use of water, we all need like a gallon a day or something to sustain ourselves. You know, we're going to have hygienic uses that I would consider pretty low. And this is where I do differ from some people. I would allow people the choice. I think people should be able to determine what water they use, but I think they should bear the full economic cost of that and not have other people bearing the cost of that for them. The net effect of subsidizing water use is that high water users get subsidized by people who use less water. That's like the net effect of all of that. There's kind of a lot behind that. And so this is where you come into those trade-offs between command and control approaches and market approaches. I like market approaches, and I would let people use a lot of water if they wanted to use a lot of water, but they would pay through the nose for it, right? And that's, that's my market-based approach. I don't think we should be in the business of telling people exactly what they should and shouldn't use water for. I think if we have the price signal right, they'll figure that out on their own. And that's what's so great about price signals. And you could vary price, you know, prices based on the level of drought. You know, conceptually at least, you could have drought-based pricing depending on, pricing may differ depending on how much reserve capacity we have in reservoirs. There's a lot you can do with pricing, but so far in the state, I think we've been, I want to caveat this, but largely unwilling to deal with that in a significant way. That being said, I think there are some places that do it. That's my caveat. But it's, I think it's, at least in my mind, I know what basic use is. Beyond that, I don't know what's a good use, just like I don't know what's a good, good amount of food or a good amount of transportation or a good amount of housing. I have a sense of what the basic need is, but beyond that, I think market prices should allow people to make choices, but with them bearing the full economic cost of those choices.
That was Phil Dean, Public Finance Senior Researcher at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here's your moderator, Carrie Case.
I'd like to move us to our next question, which is, severe droughts can have major impacts on households. How can researchers and politicians develop solutions to reduce the damages, particularly to vulnerable populations? And Juliet, maybe if I could kick this to you first.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of at the foundation is thinking about water and how we value water. And is water valued as a human right? Access to water, access to clean water. And I think if we value it in that way and ensure that all different communities and populations have access to that water, that's a starting point. Again, I talked a little bit about the stress that, you know, people might experience by facing water shortages or lack of quality water, you know, polluted water, for example. So that's important. So, you know, thinking about that as a priority, I think is the first step in good policy, especially to these vulnerable populations. I think, again, we talked about resiliency. So like implementing policies in terms of conservation, we are dealing with a supply shortage, right? That's the sort of key component to this problem, is the supply of water is not ever what, you know, we needed, right? Or need. But if we conserve water, if we put policies in to conserve water, and there's lots of different policies that other communities have used. Las Vegas in particular has decoupled population growth from water use. So in the last 20 years, as their population has grown, their use of water has actually decreased. And so they've been able to do this through returning, recycling water. They do it through really intensive conservation campaigns. Homeowners can remove turf and implement Xeriscape. There's programs that certain communities have, you know, cash for grass type policies, right? And so I think there's even some locally, there's some WaterWise programs that I actually looked into because I recently became a homeowner and needed some landscaping. And although I haven't followed through with it, you can take some landscaping and xeriscaping, sort of WaterWise landscaping classes, and then get money, an incentive to plant WaterWise in your landscape, on your property. Seasonal use of water. So again, as Phil said, he was driving home during the recent monsoon and saw people with their sprinklers out. Well, do we need sprinklers at all times of the year? Can we, you know, be more efficient in our use of water? Can we reduce the amount of turf that we have? I mean, I know the university has been making some strides in this way, sort of middle upper campus, I can't remember the building name, but they're sort of rethinking all of that turf on that area. And somebody will know this better than me what it's called, to create a more sustainable environment. Thinking about, so as Seth alluded to, or he didn't allude to, he completely spoke to the fact that we're going to become hotter and drier. So what sort of cooling mechanisms can we use that might be more efficient? How can we reduce our impact on the environment, you know, at the very small level, at our households? How do we conserve water there, but as part of a larger community? As somebody pointed out in the audience, I was seeing the chat, that agriculture uses 70% of our water. That's absolutely the case. And in fact, you know, agriculture, you know, the way our whole water right system is set up is one based on inefficient use. We call it beneficial use, but it's inefficient because if you don't use it, you lose it. And so oftentimes, you know, water is used in an inefficient way, so they don't lose it. But also, as somebody in the audience also suggested, that, you know, the crops that sometimes we are irrigating with our water are highly demanding of water, hay and alfalfa. A lot of our crops that we also produce are exported to Asian countries. So we're essentially exporting our water to other countries. And so thinking about how we as a community, you know, I've heard a statistic that if we all reduce our beef consumption by one day a week, you know, a meatless Monday, for example, that will have a huge impact on the water supply that we have. So like, those are some things at different levels of community that I think we need to think about. Those are the kind of policies we need to see in play.
Thank you, Juliet. Phil, you have something you'd like to chime in with.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on this. And I think relates to some of Teresa's world and where she works in thinking about water rights. And as you know, I'm consider myself a very strong proponent of water rights, right? And property rights in general. And so that's kind of the structure that we have, and good or bad, it's what it is right now. And so as you think about moving forward, to me, it's important to preserve those property rights, but I also think it's important to kind of make them act more like actual property rights, where there's greater ability to lease. So like the state's looking and moving into water banking and things like this, that provide this additional ability to move that water maybe in a little bit easier way than what's been done historically. You know, I go back to pricing, and I think pricing can help deal with a lot of these issues, as I think water will naturally tend to move to higher value uses over lower value uses over time. And everyone gets to figure out what that is for them. You know, you look at a lot of our rural areas of our state that are really struggling economically. And I think it's important to recognize that. And, you know, over time, those uses may transition. But it's kind of, you know, I think sometimes we think about urban poor and the challenges that they face, but I think it's also think it's important to think about our rural poor or the rural communities that are facing challenges as part of this conversation as well.
So Teresa, if you're up for it, I'd love to kick this question to you. So drought's a long-term problem. How do we keep drought and resilience needs from being overshadowed in the minds of the public and decision makers in the face of much more sort of immediate or acute disasters, such as wildfires, heat waves, and hurricanes?
Sure. So, and I guess speaking from a water right perspective, I think this last year and in every year, it was demonstrated how valuable the current water right system is. Even in severe drought conditions. To be honest, I couldn't imagine going through this last year or working in the position I have or even in the coming years without it. My agency has 120 plus years of history and experience of distributing water. And it was a hard year, but we knew what to do. And water users knew what to expect based on their existing rights. And it's a long history of those rights. And as the supply became available, we knew what adjustments needed to be made. So there's a lot to be said about the resilience of the system and the reliance on the system that has been established for decades. Now, you know, as water managers, you know, it's been and talked about that we need to be good communicators. And sometimes it's joked that engineers aren't the greatest communicators. So we really have to strive to do better at that. But we know that water is our most essential natural resource, and everyone and everything relies on water. But continued good public outreach and education is going to be key. And I know that conversation about public education and public outreach is getting stronger and is gathering some wind to keep moving that forward. So that's really all I would have to say as far as the water rate system. Be happy to talk about that at another time or later, or explain more of that, you know, but that's where I'll leave it. Since we're kind of short on time, I believe.
It's true, but that actually was one of the first audience questions that came in. So Teresa, if we could, I'd love to stick with you for a minute and ask you to say a little bit more. We had an audience question about how water rights work in Utah and how Utah's water rights compare to other states. I know that's a great big question, right? And there's a lot in there, but do you want to say just a little bit more?
Sure. So it is a huge question. And actually, we do have a YouTube channel out there that helps with water right education. That really does a deep dive into the various aspects of water right system in Utah. So essentially, it is a system that was created early on. It actually started in Wyoming. And it is a first in time, first in right system. So the first to use water claimed that right, and it became a record, and statutes went into place. And based on that use of water and those water rights, that's how we know who is first in time to receive their rights, or first in line to receive the rights. Sometimes in areas that's fully appropriated, you have to acquire existing rights. And I think Phil touched on this just a little bit, but you acquire those existing rights and change them to other uses. And how does it compare to other states? So in the West, it is a prior appropriation doctrine, and most of the Western states follow that doctrine. We're most in line with the statutes or the laws of Nevada. Nevada and Utah are fairly similar. The other Western states have slight differences in their laws. And then in the East, of course, it's a riparian doctrine. So just really simple. I think that's way high.
That was an excellent primer on Utah water rights. I appreciate you taking us through that, Teresa. I want to take another audience question. We're getting short on time, but I'm thinking we can squeeze another one in. So a member of our audience, right, that it seems like drought is becoming another excuse to further destroy the ecology of Utah's rivers and Great Salt Lake. Doesn't human resilience require resilient environments? I'd love to hear what some of the panelists think. We've talked a lot about human water needs and human water uses, and where it factors in thinking about the non-human world and their water needs. Seth?
To one very specific but important resource here in Northern Utah, and that's the Great Salt Lake. I really like to think the Great Salt Lake of this really interesting integrator of a lot that goes on in Northern Utah. It's an integrator of climate, water use, wildlife, and economics here in Northern Utah. While I think many, and myself included, at times kind of forget the Great Salt Lake, it's a really important part of both climate and ecosystems and economy here in Northern Utah. And a really huge concern. I used to work with the Division of Air Quality, and a huge concern with the Great Salt Lake is if it continues to dry, does it become a huge source of dust pollution in Northern Utah? And that's not a certainty. I want to make that clear, that just because there's dry lake bed that's there and will be there doesn't mean it definitely will be this huge environmental disaster. But there's that question. There's other dry lake beds like Owens Lake, most notably in Southern California, that was essentially dewatered by Los Angeles taking some of those water legally, buying up some of those water rights and moving that water transbasin to Los Angeles. But an externality of that decision was that lake dried up. So it no longer held value as a migratory stopover for birds, just like Great Salt Lake does. It also then became this massive source of dust. Fortunately, around Owens Lake, not a lot of people live. However, around the Great Salt Lake, we have about 2 million people, 2.5 million people that currently reside around Great Salt Lake, and this area is growing tremendously. So this is an issue that needs further study. Do we need to be giving more water to the lake? And by that, I mean that, you know, human consumption takes a lot of water out of that lake. So this is, this is the concern. I don't have an answer for that, but it's something that I think, again, comprehensively, we as a state, as you know, society around the Great Salt Lake need to focus on that, need to ask those questions and try to answer them.
All right, we are coming up on our time, but I want to put a big question out here that I think is on a lot of people's mind. And that is, so you all are experts working on this. When is it going to end? When will the current drought end? And I know you can't all predict the future, but anybody want to provide some information or wager a guess?
Can I weigh in and just go back again to what Seth was saying about climate change models? And also the case that let's stop calling it a drought. A lot of people say that we should call it aridification, right? So we have this long-term, drier, hotter weather, and this is not going to go away. There might be, as Seth said, there might be years of wetter climate or weather, but for the most part, we're going to be becoming drier and hotter. And so we need to really think about this in terms of where we're living and the reality that that's the case. You know, that's what's laid out for our future.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible, in part, by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.